Spanish today. You can go on to Radio Free Palestine on Facebook, and you can see all of that information. We are going to move back into our special programming in just a moment. Again, an hour celebrating beloved poet, taken from us all too soon, Rifat Alarir, coming up at the 7 o'clock hour. We want to let you know that you are in tune to WPFW Washington and WBAI New York as Radio Free Palestine continues.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine.
The following program is part of Radio Free Palestine, an annual 24-hour marathon airing on Nakba Day, May 15th, with participation from community and progressive radio stations and producers across five continents. The following program is Beyond the Pale, radio's home for the Jewish left, normally heard on WBAI in New York on Fridays at 9 a.m. It's a tribute to poet and writer and professor Rifat Alarir, killed by an Israeli strike in December in the Gaza Strip.
If I Must Die, by Rifat Alarir, November the 1st, 2023. If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment, an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale.
You are now listening to
Beyond the Pale, radio's home for the Jewish left,
with your hosts
Rafael Shimonov
and Shoshana Brown.
I'm your co-host, Rafael Shimonov. We open the show with a poem read by actor Brian Cox, If I Must Die, by Rifat Alarir, his final poem before Israeli forces assassinated him in Gaza, killing also his brother, his sister, and all of her four children. Rifat was taken from his wife and both his children, 7 and 21. The poem you heard was his last piece of writing. It was addressed to his daughter, Shema Rifat Alarir. The poem, our directions. Our directions were what to do in the event of his death. Weeks ago, she too was killed by Israeli forces, including her husband, her 2-month-year-old son as well, and Rifat's grandchild. This is a really difficult show to do because we actually attempted to do it last show, and I just couldn't edit it. Rifat and I weren't like friends in real life. We for years would troll like right wingers and, you know, apartheid and pro genocide people.
Which, by the way, officials is like the best way to become friends with you.
Yeah, it is the best way. The best way to become friends with me is to conspire in trolling Hasbarists and government
and officials. Nazis
and
on Twitter.
And he also had this beautiful, wicked kind of dark sense of humor, which is actually used today, of course, to like try to smear him, like, you know, like, which almost always is taken out of context in order to smear him. I stand by his dark humor. And, during that time, his last words with me were about how appreciative he was of like the Jewish American response to Gaza, to the attack on Gaza. And he became so excited by that, both because of how he thought it was strategic to do so as Jews, but also just out of love, like out of seeing each other and solidarity, and being a person of history and understanding the importance of solidarity and love. And if you go to his Twitter, you'll see him very much fanboying. As we fanboyed Rafat, you'll see him fanboying all of our actions at the Statue of Liberty, at Grand Central, blocking the White House in front of Chuck Schumer's. You know, he very much was an internationalist, I think, in a very classic sense. And I didn't know from years that I interacted with him, and I didn't know that he was a guest on Beyond the Pale prior to my and Shoshana's revival of it. Beyond the Pale had existed, it had a gap like for 10 years prior to when we launched it, relaunched it. And it ran for like 19 years before then. And in 2014, March 30th, like about 10 years ago, Rafat and his one of his students, Youssef Al-Jamal, was on. And they were on a U.S. tour promoting the book Gaza Speaks. And that book is Rafat showcasing many of his student writers. Rafat was a comparative literature professor. And he was and a poet, of course, but showcasing a lot of his students and beyond of their writings in English to American, and really, you know, in the midst of a siege that predated, of course, October 7th, a siege on Gaza that limited nutrition and electricity and water and jobs and movement. And in fact, he was supposed to appear also, as you'll learn, with another student, but Israel blocked her. So today, it's kind of like we decided we're going to play the archives. And we were going to play them last week, and during editing, I just couldn't finish because of like how difficult that was to hear his voice. But we've done it, and we did it with help. I've been in touch. Thank you to Ari Bloomkatz at In These Times, who put me in touch with his student, Youssef Al-Jamal. And Youssef and I have been chatting and sending voice notes to each other. And he's going to intro our show for us and put it into context. And this whole show is also going to be carried on In These Times in Chicago in some way or another. So you should look out for that. And thank you, Ari Bloomkatz. Yeah, I think we could. Shoshana, I feel like we could just play these clips and just react to them just as, you know, just as anyone would, just processing them.
And, let's do it.
Yeah.
I want to hear them. I'm very
and you'll hear kind of like old classic Beyond the Pale, like intro as well. And also important to mention,
my favorite part,
the host of that, there was a rotating host of Beyond the Pale at that point, because it was just so hard for the original two hosts to carry it all. They brought in a lot of amazing people. And one of the amazing people is Alex B. Kane, who is interviewing both of them. And you'll hear his voice in the archives later on as well. So, Michael, could we play Youssef's like intro for us?
Around this time, 10 years ago, Rifat, Rawan, and I were touring the east coast of the United States promoting Gaza rights back. And we were co-sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee, and just with the books which published Rifat's two edited books, Gaza Writes Back and Gaza Unsilenced. It feels very challenging today to reflect on, you know, 10 years of work and solidarity that Rifat created in Gaza, especially among young people, where he trained hundreds and even thousands of young writers to believe in themselves and believe that every one of them had a story that deserved to be told. So the legacy of Rifat, you know, is huge. And one thing that Rifat is known for, and his legacy will continue to tell over the next few years, is that he was very clear on his stance, and one of the people that he appreciated in his life was Malcolm X. So Rifat, the same as Malcolm X, was also revolutionary in the sense that he always thought outside the box and tried to find solutions, even under siege in Gaza. Solutions to problems we had and challenges we had. He would encourage students to, you know, seek education abroad and to continue telling their stories. And he invested so much in storytelling that he made it his mission in life to educate young writers on storytelling and writing and narrative. And he remained true to his principles until the last day of his life. He refused to leave the north of Gaza. He loved his town, Shija'iyah. He would make comparisons about Shija'iyah and Chicago, calling Chicago the Shija'iyah of the U.S. and New York is Zaytun of the U.S. And Zaytun is another neighborhood in Gaza. There's a similar competition that we have between Shija'iyah and Zaytun that we have between Chicago and New York. So he had a great sense of humor. He would, you know, inject many dark jokes into his teaching, and he had a very humorous character. He would make everyone around him feel joyful and happy, but at the same time he had great knowledge. He would share what he had with his students. He loved his students, and that's why his students loved him, and his legacy continues today through thousands of kites that people, you know, fly in Rifat's memory, writing his words and poetry. Rifat is immortal. We don't think that Rifat is gone. Maybe he's physically gone, but his ideas will continue to thrive and spread. Now millions of people know him because of his poetry, because of his writings, because of his activism. After killing him on December 6th, Israel was not satisfied. They killed him along with some of his family members, his nephews and nieces, but also his brother. And just last Friday, they also bombed an international organization where his daughter, who gave birth less than 3 months ago, was sheltering with her newborn and her husband, and three of them were killed. So, you know, they even are now after his family and trying to also kill other family members. But as I said, you know, killing someone doesn't end their life, and Rifat is an example, especially someone who has a great legacy and someone who planted the seeds of a revolution and freedom for Palestinians. We will continue to see Rifat, you know, generation after another, in his writings, in his books, and his memory will live forever, and we will never forgive his killers, and we will never forget him. He lives with us every day.
Yeah. Yusef is now himself a scholar, Dr. Al-Jamal, and co-author of A Shared Struggle, Stories of Palestinian and Irish Hunger Strikers, published in 2021. And I think he still works with Palestine Activism Program at the American Friends Service Committee. Yusef himself is a refugee from Gaza, of course, and also has been a non-resident scholar for Palestine studies in Malaysia as well. So just like all over the world, Turkey, Malaysia, Yusef is everywhere, really. If you look at Yusef's Twitter, which is at Yusef Al-Jamal, there's a kite in a lot of his posts and a lot in his bio. His profile picture is Rifat. And he's just consistently like making sure, and I think the whole world is making sure that you can't kill Rifat. As you could see, Shoshana, you yourself saw something at an encampment, which had his name.
Yeah, at CUNY, at the City College encampment, they set up a library and it was named after him. So there was a library there, and I was immediately shocked, and I remember being like, oh my gosh, Rafael was just talking to me about this. Like, you were just telling me about him. And then I get there and I see a library named after him. So it's just really like powerful to know that, despite the repression, despite, the silencing of speech, of knowledge, of relationship to and with Palestinians, we are in relationship. Like, we are humans. We are connected, no matter the challenges that face us, the memories and community is shared, that these young people and CUNY's campus knew who he was, you know, and that to me is like really beautiful.
On Twitter, there's this group called Jinx Press. They wrote and they put pictures up of another Rifat Alarir library and wrote, if you sum up all these spontaneous encampment libraries, and if the current growth trend holds, Rifat may have more libraries dedicated to his memory now than any other person in history. That's wild. And probably just as many libraries now destroyed by police who are destroying these encampments. But yet, everywhere I go, like, people are aware of this poem, are aware of this person.
Yeah. Well, it's really, you know, we've been talking about it, and the thing that is really striking is, you know, you said like this library was destroyed by the NYPD, right? Destroy the people's libraries. And we know that that's right out of the playbook, right? Like burning books, banning books, controlling the flow of knowledge is just it's authoritarian.
What was the word you used for it?
Oh, scholasticide.
Yeah, I've
the destruction,
heard that
the destruction of education, you know, the destruction of our knowledge systems. And I remember when I went to Berlin just last summer, almost a year ago, actually, I went to the memorial for burned books. And it's basically this window into the ground, and underneath the ground is an empty library, like bookshelves and bookshelves that are just empty. And it reminds me that this is really a moment for us to take a look and see like what side of history are we really on? Like, who, what are we turning into? Especially when I hear about Hunter College going remote. Last week they went remote, and I understand that they went remote because they heard that students were planning an encampment. And it's my understanding that there are a few students that are facing suspension hearings for thinking about setting up an encampment, not setting up the encampment, not, you know, putting anything out publicly, but like, this is how far we're getting into thought policing. And this all just connects right back to Rafat, you know?
Yeah. We have, we should probably do a station ID. You are listening to Beyond the Pale, Radio's Home for the Jewish Left, here on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming on WBAI.org. That's where you get us live. After we show, like maybe a couple of hours after, you could find us on your favorite podcast apps now. This show will be on there as well, and typically also on SoundCloud, if that's your thing. We're your hosts, me, Rafael Shimonov, and Shoshana Brown. And today we're talking about Rafat Alarir and the Beyond the Pale archives with his interview, his and Yusuf's interview. And Michael, we have like the intro from Alex Kane to play. And if you could start us with that.
Welcome to Beyond the Pale on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. Today's show is a special one. I'm going to be playing an interview I conducted with Ali Abu Nima, the author of the recently released book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. It is a great conversation. But another reason I'm excited about today's show is because of my first segment. I'm going to have with me two special guests from the Gaza Strip, currently in the United States, on a book tour. It is quite rare to have the chance to directly speak with people from Gaza, given Israel's severe restrictions on Palestinian freedom of movement and the ongoing blockade and closure of the territory. So this radio audience is quite blessed. First, a bit of background on Gaza. It is located on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, and it's a relatively small strip of land bordered by Egypt and Israel. 70% of its population of 1.6 million people is made up of refugees from the 1948 Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe, which refers to the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians from present-day Israel. In recent years, Gaza has been in the headlines because of a devastating Israeli blockade that has crippled the Strip's economy. And in 2008 to 2009, Israel waged what it called Operation Cast Lead, a devastating assault on Gaza, killing some 1,400 people, the majority of them civilians. The assault had a profound impact on Gaza's people, and my guests are no exception. Rifat Alarir and Yusuf Al-Jamal are, respectively, the editor and a contributor to the new book, Gaza Writes Back, a compilation of stories from 15 young writers from the Palestinian enclave.
That was the intro of Alex setting it up with the that beautiful klezmer, that klezmer intro. Maybe we should start playing some of that, the classic intros.
You know, we gotta get some musicians to give us a klezmer remix.
Oh, you hear that, musicians out there? I know plenty of klezmer musicians who are listening right now, that are probably writing on their notepad right now. That clip is such a reminder too of how similar it just sounds. This book was a response to another Israeli operation sometimes you catch yourself using the terms they kind of stick in your brain by repetition. The news, Hezbollah, you know, like it's operation. The operations are like when my dad was saved from a stroke or my mom was saved from a heart attack. Those are operations. This is not an operation. Where the attack on Palestinian civilians in Gaza, this book was a response to that and a reminder of how Gaza has been under siege, how these Palestinians came on this show, on this station, and toured the U.S. and did the same thing everywhere around the whole East Coast, and asking us to notice them, to prevent what you're seeing now, to prevent genocide, to prevent even October 7th. Like if you're someone who's like tuning in and curious about the show and you're kind of parroting those talking points about the left doesn't care about the Israeli captives in Gaza. When we say ceasefire, it includes that. When we say end apartheid, it includes not having the environment that creates violence. Like it's implicit. And so I just want to be clear about that, that these people, Rafat, his students, all the people in this book were crying out to, in English, like actually learning English to, in order to, they're going to talk about that too, in order to prevent all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we say liberation, we mean liberation for everybody. When we say Palestinian liberation, that includes everybody's liberation. Yeah. When we liberate those who are the most oppressed in our societies, that is a doorway for all of us. And if you are new to understanding that, I welcome you to undo some of the capitalist mindset that has overtaken your understanding of what freedom and liberation can look like. The idea that it's one or the other, the idea that them versus us rather than them and us, all of us rather. I welcome you to really begin to notice the ways that a capitalist mindset of there only being but so much, there's only but so much, and we have to slice the pie, rather than understanding that liberation exists in abundance, that we actually can access it. And when we access it, it's accessed for all of us. And to begin to see yourself, even if you are not Palestinian, to begin to see yourself in how can you and your people benefit from Palestinian liberation? What would that mean for, how would that change how you understand yourself? What could become free when you are not held captive to the constructs that are also creating oppression, devastation, genocide in Palestine? Because those same oppressive powers are also holding you in constriction as well.
There is this notion of us standing with Palestinians to free Palestinians in this, like, frankly, white supremacist, like, savior complexy way, where you really talk to people in the encampments protesting, or Palestinians, anti-Zionist Jews, even some of these people who still dare to call themselves liberal Zionist Jews, like a lot of them say, a lot of them push back on that. They've learned to push back on that idea, that white supremacist idea of like charity, of advocacy, like this transactional nature of like, I have more privilege than you and I'm going to grace you with. Instead, I think, like, I really appreciated your, Shoshana, your talk in Kingston last week. And you were on this panel and you really just kept reminding everyone the bigger part of this machine, that we're kind of zoomed in right now on this like gas, like the exhaust pipe of a machine. And there's this like wider view of like right-wing Christian hegemonic like control, and how it plays us against each other, and how this serves, this all serves that. Today there was someone on Twitter who a lot of people follow. I'm not going to name them right now, but like they posted like the most, one of the most anti-Semitic, old tropes about like this like theory that Ashkenazi Jews are secretly this like Turkish sect of people who are pretending to be Jewish and converted. And now Ashkenazis are just like cosplaying as Jews and they're real Jews. Like, and that therefore anything they say against Jews can't be anti-Semitic. Like, just like weird stuff like that. And it just, your talk caused me to like examine that and be like, oh, that's because people are, it went viral. And people are susceptible to it when there is no explanation to why there's a gap in rational something, you know, like the answer, like something's going on. I don't have the answer to why. So if something sounds like it fits in it, it's just going to fit in it. So the best way to inoculate that is to have an analysis already in place. So when someone tries to like grift their way and place anti-Semitism in it, and it just like prove exactly your point of like anti-Semitism's design, like to distract us from capitalism, to distract us from white supremacy. And that's what it did. It became this viral conversation of like this debate about if this like quote unquote Jews are somehow this secret society in the world, instead of us actually acknowledging what's at play here.
You are listening to Beyond the Pale, Radio's home for the Jewish left. And we're about halfway through the show here on WBAI 99.5 FM and on WBAI.org. And we're your hosts. Me, I'm Shoshana Brown, and I'm here with my co-host, Rafael Shimonov. And today we are playing the archives of Rafat Alarir. And it is only here that you actually get to learn about who this amazing Palestinian poet, writer, educator is. It's only here where on WBAI, Rafael can go back into like the NYU labor archives and pull up clips and archives from shows, from this show, from years ago, that are just still relevant today. So we can't do this without your support. And I am asking you today to be a BAI buddy. If you haven't become one, do it today. Be a monthly sustaining donor. And you can call 212-209-2950 or go to give the number 2WBAI.org. And be a buddy, be a monthly sustaining donor to help our station stay on the air to keep information like this. Let's keep the information continuing to flow. Let's keep popular public education available, despite the authoritarian powers that are trying to shut down in any way they can a people's history, a people's community. But you're getting it right here. So Raf, let's play more.
Yeah. Michael, could we do the number two guest talking about the book?
Rifat is the editor of Gaza Writes Back. He's an academic from Gaza. He teaches literature and writing at the Islamic University of Gaza. And Youssef is a 24-year-old blogger from Gaza and is currently doing an MA at the University of Malaya in Malaysia. They're currently touring the U.S. Welcome to Beyond the Pale, Youssef and Rifat.
Hello. Hello, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. I want to start with Rifat. Could you explain to our audience, you know, how this book project started and why you think it's important?
Okay. Again, thank you for having me and giving me this great chance
The Gaza Rights Back book was probably physically, the whole idea was born exactly after the Operation Cast Lib attack on Gaza that left thousands of people dead and injured and displaced. We came out of the after the attacks with so many horrendous stories, personal stories, stories of pain and suffering and determination and resilience to tell. I personally was living in an area that is considered very, very hot because it's very near to the Israeli borders between East Gaza and the borders. So I personally witnessed so many stories myself. When I went back to my classes, I also asked my students to consider telling their stories, to think of different ways to engage the whole world with the pain and suffering we have in the Gaza Strip. And then because those students already know English, because they're studying English, it wasn't a very difficult task. All it needed is a small nudge, and we started meeting regularly, deciding and determined to tell our stories in order to again communicate with the outside world with the English language rather than with in Arabic, and therefore we started like short story writing sessions, creative writing sessions, in order to improve the skills themselves of how to tell a story and how to tell it in a way that would be universal and at the same time timeless.
Timeless, yeah.
Beautiful. It's not easy to tell a story.
It is not easy, and it's interesting. Like that back then, it was like blogging was the thing. So they introduced Yusuf as a blogger too. And right now, I guess like the equivalent is like TikTok and Instagram of how we're hearing Palestinian voices. Rafat in a lot of these archives speaks about having to train people in English and train people in writing to make sure they can be heard throughout the world. And you could see, in opposition to billions of dollars and nation states silencing these voices, that the work Rafat and Yusuf and others have done to prepare Palestinians to speak to the world during this time is winning. Like, they're unable to silence them, and in effect, they're reaching people their age around the world who are just like, no. And then the question of like, back to the other point about liberation, it's making us question and making them question our own systems. Like, why is Columbia University so invested in weapons manufacturing? Why is MIT so invested in scanning people's faces and using that for like targeting? Why is Google involved with apartheid? All these questions. So you can argue Palestine is freeing us as well, because we're able to examine our own systems that oppress us here at home, because they're so connected.
Yeah, and I have to shout out, I heard last night UC Sacramento divested. So there's movement. That's the thing. There is movement. It is possible. Another world is possible. People have been in the streets for this for so, so, so long. And it's possible for us to get free. It's possible for us to just take a pause and look back and say, is this how we want to be living in the world? Is this who we want to be? We are the most powerful country in the world. Do we really think that this is the thing that actually makes us power? Is this where we actually get our power from? Or can we be powerful in new and different ways that don't rely on oppressing other people, that don't rely on genocide, that don't rely on war?
Michael, we have the next clip is 2.5, and that's really about, you know, Rafat's process for selecting. They got a lot of stories for this book, this is how he decided which ones get into the book.
Rafat, there are over 20 stories in here by different writers. How did you choose which stories to pick, and you know, where did they come from? Did they come from a class? Were they outside your literature class at the Islamic University, or what?
The process of selection was not easy, I have to admit, because many of the stories came from the classes themselves. But since we called for submission, when I announced that I'm working on a book, I received close to 70, 80 stories, and I had to go through the painful process of shortlisting and narrowing down the number of stories, because we wanted to have 23 stories for the 23 days of Israeli aggression and bombing on the people of Gaza. So the whole idea of 23 is because, again, of the 23 days, not because we didn't have enough good stories, because there's still, I tell you, there are still many, many good stories out there in Gaza, and hopefully this can come in other books. So the stories came from the classes, but also they came from outside classes, because people interacted wonderfully with the whole idea of being published globally, of having their voices heard by the people around the world.
Yeah. And we have Youssef talking about his story, because Youssef was a contributor at the time. Michael, if you could play three Youssef brothers.
I want to go to Youssef. I was wondering if you could talk about your experience in contributing and working on the book, and also how do you think the stories in the book contribute to the Palestinian struggle?
Thank you again for having us. It was a pleasure to meet you in Gaza.
It was a pleasure to meet you too a couple years ago.
Gaza Freedom March in 2010, and great to talk to you today. I started writing in 2010 about life in Gaza. My first article was published on Mondo Weiss in the U.S. Then I started writing about, you know, my personal experience on the occupation and how occupation affected my family, especially that I lost my eldest brother in 2004 when Israel attacked our refugee camp. I lost my sister in 2007 because she was denied a medical permit to travel to Jerusalem. So I started writing about, you know, these experiences. My mother was denied a permit to visit her family in the West Bank for 12 years. Then, you know, this idea of writing fiction, I wrote about my brother, Omar, who was killed by Israel in 2004. And the article was published by Electronic Intifada. It was called Why I Have Two Brothers Named Omar. 2 years after my brother was killed in Gaza, my mother delivered another baby boy and named him after my eldest brother. So I ended up with two brothers named Omar. One is my eldest brother, and one is my youngest brother. And this is what my story is about. It's about my eldest brother who was shot and left, you know, bleeding for 4 hours, then passed away. And my youngest brother, who is now, you know, struggling and living with the fact that he's named after another brother who was killed.
They reference Alex, actually, and him actually meeting in Gaza Freedom March, which was a planned march during the blockade of Gaza, and it was after a huge attack, Operation Cast Lead, operation, gas led by Israel. It was quite a remarkable attempt of like thousands of people from, I don't know, more than 40 countries or so assembled and were planning to join Palestinians in this march. And it was blocked. And a lot of Hasbara has you say, like, look at Egypt. You'll see this talking point all the time. Look, Egypt doesn't let Palestinians in. Egypt has a wall. Egypt has all these things. Egypt is also a client state of U.S. imperialism. Egypt requires U.S. donations of literally rice because of how much we've disinvested and damaged Egyptian infrastructure and society with imperialism. So they often answer to the U.S. Egypt's people are different than its government. Egypt's government is an authoritarian government infamous for torture. In fact, they coordinate with Israelis and Americans to send where we would send, quote unquote, terror suspects for torture to Egyptian forces. So let's just, you know, just a reminder. And Egypt blocked that event. And just another long line of stories of peaceful, nonviolent actions being blocked by U.S. forces, by Israel forces. And then, of course, violence erupting from that because peace is blocked, because the steam is sealed. And then, of course, violence erupts and people say, why weren't you peaceful? As you know, another march more recent, when people assembled to do a march, were full of Israeli snipers shooting nonviolent marchers in the legs. They touched on that. And then I think we're going to move real quick to Youssef talking about BDS. Michael, number four.
I'm sure you've been following somewhat the debate in the United States about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement and the academic boycott. And, you know, the American Studies Association recently voted to boycott Israeli academic institutions. And I think the story of Sarah really shows the importance of the boycott. You know, there's a lot of talk, this boycott might violate academic freedom, but Israel is continually violating the academic freedom of Palestinians like Sarah Ali and other Palestinians. So Youssef, what, you know, talk about how people in Gaza and you view the BDS movement and the academic boycott, talk about its place in sort of the struggle for Palestine.
Academic boycott is extremely important as part and parcel of the comprehensive BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel, which includes economic, academic, culture, and political boycott of Israel. The academic boycott is extremely important, as I just mentioned, because Israel discriminates against Palestinian students, prevents them from going to their schools outside Palestine and even to the West Bank. For the students in Gaza who want to go to the West Bank, they cannot go to the West Bank universities, and West Bank students cannot go to Gaza universities. Israeli institutions and universities are complicit in apartheid, the apartheid crime in Palestine by maintaining apartheid. For example, the Technion Institute in Haifa contributes to Israel's apartheid by providing the Israeli military with the drones to kill Palestinians, including Palestinian students. So the academic boycott is important. We have seen the UN divest recently, and the Michigan College divestment motions, and the ASA in December last year. This is extremely important, and when Israeli academics and Israeli institutions and universities feel threatened, they will act and pressure the government to change its policies regarding Palestinians, especially Palestinian students at Palestinian universities. In 2008-2009, Israel destroyed one of the main buildings in the Islamic University of Gaza, and they targeted hundreds of Palestinian schools, and including the American school, International American School in Gaza. So this is extremely important for Americans to take actions against Israeli academics, Israeli academic institutions who are completely complicit in the apartheid crime in Palestine.
And that's unfortunately all the time we have. Youssef and Rifat, thank you so much for joining me. They are on tour in the U.S. in support of their book, Gaza Writes Back. They will be in New York on April 4th at 7:30 p.m. at New York University. You could visit justworldbooks.com for more information. Thank you, Youssef and Rifat.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And stay tuned to Beyond the Pale. I will be back in a minute.
What a beautiful pair of voices that we had on this show. I really just want to do, Shoshana, I really want to hear like the proper way to close a show like this. But I also want to thank a lot of people who made this possible. Our engineer, Michael G. Haskins, who hosts his own show, Living for the City, every Wednesday, 11 a.m., 99.5 FM. Youssef, of course, for helping us. You could find his stuff on In These Times and all over if you Google Youssef Al-Jamal on Twitter. Alex B. Kane, that's alexbkane.com, Kane with a K. And the founders of this show, Marilyn Kleinberg-Niemark and Esther Kaplan, those voices wouldn't be going across New York airwaves 10 years ago and again now without those two and Jay Fredge and for launching this show. And of course, the Tenement Library at Robert F. Wagner Labor Archives at NYU. And specifically Shannon O'Neill and Malia Geyer Stevens, who stayed up like on vacations and at night to make sure that we have those archives in time.
And just bringing us back. And this day we're here and we chose a different tone for today's conversation. We're usually chatty and bubbly and cracking all kinds of jokes and being silly. But, today we wanted to settle into the seriousness of what it means, to lose great thinkers. And also to honor not only who, Rifat Alarir was, but also what he lifted up and what he stood for, including the way in which, and we didn't get to this part, but the way in which he lifted up women and the role of women, both in Palestinian liberation movements and also in Palestinian society in general. And I think that is such a through line and something that is just akin and shared with us as Jewish people, and just lifting up how that work continues through spaces like the Palestinian Feminist Collective. So today, we want to end with a dedication of our time here, of our learning together of Rifat and his legacy, of his daughter and his grandchild. May their memories be a blessing. And if you'll take two breaths with me to notice how this has sat in your body. To take a moment to slow down. To be present with the grief all around us that we are all feeling, acknowledged or unacknowledged. We are living through hard times, and it is important for us to notice how those times land in our bodies and change the cellular structures of our skin and our minds, our body cells. How that these memories will be imprinted in our cells and passed down to generations. What story will you tell of who you were in this moment?
WBAI New York. We're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Nakba Day, Radio Free Palestine. Wednesday, May 15th, 2024, is the 76th anniversary of the ongoing Palestinian Nakba and resistance to Israeli apartheid. Radio Free Palestine launches on WBAI, WPFW, KPFK, and dozens of stations across North America. We are broadcasting programs from radio stations and producers across five continents with analysis and discussion, speeches, music, poetry, and updates from student encampments. The Nakba anniversary is a reminder not only of those tragic events of 1948, but the ongoing injustice suffered by the Palestinians. In this past hour, you heard Beyond the Pale on WBAI Fridays at 9 a.m., Radio's Home for the Jewish Left with Rafael Shimonov and Shoshana Brown. I'm the Michael that you kept hearing about for the past few minutes. I'm Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide weekday mornings. And we're able to play these kinds of programs, offer you these kinds of stories because we are listener-sponsored and commercially free. Now, we have a lot going on here at WBAI. We're trying to raise funds for our respective radio stations, Washington, D.C., and here in New York. We're trying to do this so that we can continue the commercial-free broadcasting that we've been doing here at WBAI since 1960, 64 years in the center of the FM dial here in New York City. What we'd like you to do right now, I'm asking you to do right now, is to make a contribution in support of WBAI so we can pay down the tower fund, our transmitter, so we can broadcast terrestrially over three different states, 90 miles in all directions. Our pledge line is always open and available. If you would call right now, just before we go to Democracy Now!, the number is 212-209-2950. Here in New York, locally, your radio station, it's 212-209-2950. You could become a sustaining member for as little as $15 a month. A sustaining member, or we like to call it a BAI buddy, is someone that would help defray those costs, someone that we can depend on each and every month, so we know how much money is coming into the station. We get no corporate donations or contributions. All of our money since 1960 comes from listeners just like you. That's 212-209-2950. That's the call center. You can also pledge online at WBAI.org. WBAI.org. We have a dedicated site for all kinds of gifts that we can send you, thanking you for supporting us. But you know something? The most important thing is not the gift at all. The gift is, it's an added incentive. But what is important is to have a program like Beyond the Pale, to have a radio station, have radio stations, WPFW and WBAI, so that we can donate, we can isolate 24 hours of programming like this. That's what the premium is. I always say the program is the premium. So give us a call now at 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, and make that contribution. You could become a sustaining member or a first-time subscriber for as little as $25 a month or more.